Okay, welcome to Eric's Perspective. Joining us today at M. Hanks Gallery is Paul Von Blum, senior lecturer at UCLA in African-American Studies and Communication Studies and author of 8 books. Paul, thanks for coming. Welcome.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. You know, I love to talk, so this is just another opportunity to talk.
Excellent.
So we'll do it.
Okay, so let's just have a little chat. You know, okay. So starting first with, you've authored a couple of different books on African-American art. I was just curious to know, how did you get attracted to the subject of African-American art?
Now, I have been involved with the African-American community pretty much my entire life. It stems very much from my family background. I think you know some of the stories, but I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Oh, please, please.
My parents were politically active my entire life. I come from a politically active family. My parents were involved in 1957 in breaking the color line in Levittown, Pennsylvania. That was my earliest involvement in the civil rights movement. It's something that I talk about in my class and that I've written about in my memoir. Mm-hmm. In 1957, we were living in Levittown, Pennsylvania, which was an all-white suburb, one of those so-called sundown towns. And my parents and a couple of other white families realized that that was horrible. And so in 1957, they helped a black family named the Myers moved in. They knew that there was going to be trouble. I was the oldest then of four. Mm-hmm. Fifth came along later when we moved to California. Mm-hmm. But we had no idea that it would be absolutely horrible. When the Myers moved in, we had mobs of people. I mean, in fact, inspired by the Ku Klux Klan. Now, this is north of Philadelphia.
Oh, my God.
This is Pennsylvania. Wow. And the night that they moved in, an enormous mob gathered, calling everybody, including us, nigger lover, nigger lover, nigger lover. And I used that language because it was real. And I'm not afraid to use it. That night, it took the governor of the state, George Leader, to send out the national, well, he took out the Pennsylvania State Police to break it up. But for weeks afterwards, a group called the Levittown Betterment Committee had caravans of cars waving Confederate flags. That was in August 1957. And in September 1957, they burned a cross on our lawn. And that was, in fact, inspired by the Ku Klux Klan. I was a witness to it at about 3:30 or 4 in the morning. I saw them leave. To fast forward a little bit, it was a pretty horrendous time, but I wound up testifying in December 1957 against the Ku Klux Klan, my earliest involvement in civil rights, way back in 1957.
So how old were you then?
I was 14.
Wow.
And I was I was a witness. I testified against the leaders of the Betterment Committee, including a man named Jim Newell. I stood up in court and I identified him as the person who called me and others nigger lover. Again, to fast forward, my family was ostracized. My father lost a number of jobs. It was, as I explained to my students, the end of kind of the tail end of McCarthyism.
Oh, wow.
My family and a couple of the other families were basically blacklisted. And in short, we had to move to California in order to get away from that kind of blacklisting.
Was there any time when you guys were under threat of violence? I mean, they did.
Often.
Yeah.
Often.
Were you ever physically attacked?
I was physically attacked. My younger brother was physically attacked. I was ostracized in the neighborhood.
And what about the black family? They must have been subjected to a lot of horrendous terrorist-type activities.
They withheld the terror, the threats, and they stood their ground and they made it. Like the African Americans in the South, they were the true heroes. And I try to explain to my students, people like me were supporting actors. When we came to California to kind of rebuild our lives, I was still in high school. But by the time I got to college, I knew I had to continue the struggle. At that point, I knew I had to be one of those people who went south. So I was one of those kids who went to the South. I went to Georgia. I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And early on, I started going into the sit-ins, those kind of classic sit-ins. What was interesting was that in Atlanta, Georgia, I sat in at a place called Charlie Leb's Restaurant. And it was 1962 where I was at the same set of demonstrations with one of the most wonderful people I've ever met, Congressman John Lewis, who is now in the fight for his life.
Yeah.
And we all hope that he makes it. It's possible. It's possible. We want him to make it.
Well, of course.
But I spent much of the next several years, even while I was a student, intermittently going south.
So when you were in South, I mean, how did you feel? Did you feel afraid? Were you looking over your shoulder? I mean, how were you on a personal level? How was that?
I was sometimes afraid, but when you're 19 and 20, you don't quite have the same apprehension of fear that you do when you're older. It's not like I was reckless. I was never reckless, but I never had the same sense of fear that you get later.
Yeah.
It really was. I was not reckless, but when you're younger, you do things because you're committed to it. We took steps. We took caution, but I was so committed to this struggle. It has been the struggle of my life. Huh. I've been political in a wide variety of other ways, but during my undergraduate years, this is what I was doing. I was in California. I was doing it here.
When you say California, was that all the time in the Los Angeles area?
No. We actually were in San Diego.
Okay.
And as an undergraduate, I went to San Diego State.
Oh.
But I told my professors, I'm going to be away for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I'm happy to do my assignments. And in one memorable time, I wrote a political science term paper sitting on, I don't remember what restaurant. I actually wrote it while we were having a sit-in. I wrote it in hand. And I mailed it back. In an envelope with stamps. My students don't know how to do that today.
Right. Do you recall what grade you got on it?
I got an A.
Excellent.
I was good at it.
You deserve an A just for the effort part of it.
Doing it. But I was in Georgia. I was in the most dangerous places were in Alabama. We were in Montgomery. We were arrested. I tell my students it's true. I was arrested on the road allegedly for a holdup in a gas station. We were charged with armed robbery.
Oh, boy.
You've known me for years. I'm not an armed robber.
No.
I don't
do guns.
You were
the last person I was expecting to be.
So we were taken to the Montgomery jail.
Oh, my.
Battered around a little bit and released.
How long are you in the jail?
Several hours. Then they kicked us. That was common in the civil rights movement.
It's an intimidation tactic.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So we paid our dues. We were there.
Yeah.
I don't remember which year we did which. You know, a lot of people. I've had a number of oral histories, and my memory is very good. But I don't recall which year and which place. I was at the March on Washington when Dr. King gave his speech. I know that.
Well, my mother was there too, by the way.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders was there.
Yeah.
You know, I tell my students I was looking. I said, "Bernie, where are you?" But I couldn't find him. I can't know all the people were there.
No, it's tons of people that were there.
250,000 people.
Which was a good thing. I mean, it was a good show of support for a worthy cause.
It was one of the most memorable days in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I had been involved in the movement before. And I remember Dr. King saying, "We'll do this together. We'll go to jail together." And I did.
Yeah.
I went back to Alabama. I went to New Orleans, one of my favorite cities. I got beaten up on Canal Street,
not badly. Oh, boy.
You know, I had nonviolent training. You know, a couple of thugs beat me up. I love telling the story to my guest students. A couple of thugs beat me up. Phoebe Beasley did a wonderful picture. It's in my book, and it holds up a sign that says, "Don't buy where you can't work."
Right.
It's a magnificent painting. I held that same sign, not the one that she painted, but I held that sign on Canal Street, and two white thugs came and knocked me to the ground.
Oh, boy.
But we were committed to nonviolence.
Yeah.
And I never fought back because that's what we did. And they didn't hurt me badly. I knew how to do self-defense. So what happened was that after 5 minutes, they got frustrated. These thugs didn't know what to do with somebody not fighting back.
Right.
And two New Orleans cops watched the whole thing. And when I finally got up, the two New Orleans cops came and said to the two thugs who beat me up, "Are you hurt?"
To the thugs.
To the thugs. Do you want to press charges? And as I love to tell my students, apparently I injured their feet with my ribs. No, but that was also very typical in the movement.
Yeah.
And I just kept doing stuff like that. I was I was mostly not in Mississippi, although I talked to people. But I want to reiterate, I was just a supporting actor. The real heroes were the African Americans in the South. They had to stay.
Yeah, they lived it.
They lived it. I could go back and become a university student again. And in 1964, I graduated from college, and I knew that I wanted to continue. I wasn't just going to stop with a BA.
Right.
And so I applied for and was accepted to the PhD program in political science at Berkeley. I really wanted to be in Berkeley. I mean, Berkeley was where everything was happening. I had done civil rights movement in Los Angeles, even while I was an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
We had picketed Vandy Camp's bakery here, in the LA area, some other places. But I was in San Diego. I actually went earlier on my birthday, my 21st birthday, on March 30th, 1943. 1964, and CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, mm-hmm. had sent me to Phoenix, and we organized a huge set of demonstrations in the Capitol, and I and a few other people occupied the governor's office in the state capitol, and we were taken out by, it was four highway patrolmen.
Physically removed you.
One on each arm, one on each leg.
So you're just carried away.
Yes, and one of the police officers deposited me on the grounds of the state capitol, and then looked at me and said, "I'm going to use the language that he used." He said, "If I see you again in the governor's office, I'm going to beat the shit out of you."
Mm.
And I love to tell my students that it was an honest comp.
Yeah, right. I mean, good Lord.
Because that's, we rushed
but the... But he's a police officer, and he's talking to you in that manner.
We rushed the governor's office again, and we reoccupied it. This is on my birthday, so it's one of those dates that I remember.
Did you encounter that same police officer?
Same officer.
Did he beat the crap out of you?
This time, he took me behind a police car, and when nobody was looking, he punched me in the face.
Oh my goodness.
And I don't know, a few months later, he cracked the roots of my bottom teeth, and they had to be removed.
Oh, wow.
So, but...
did you do anything about it?
There's nothing I could do. It would be...
It would be pointless to bring a...
Totally.
A legal action against him.
His word against mine.
Right. That's why he took you, just the two of you behind.
Yes. Who would they believe?
Yeah, right, right.
So
did you finish your PhD at UC Berkeley?
No, because
you ended up becoming a lawyer, though.
In San Diego, on June 26th, there are days that I remember, but I also tell my students I was in the moment. I didn't record everything.
Right.
And we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have any of that paraphernalia.
Right, right.
So on June 26th, I had just graduated with my BA, and I was going to go to Berkeley. I was arrested at the Bank of America. And
for what?
For a series of demonstrations against the discriminatory hiring policies. They wouldn't hire African Americans.
You mean at the bank?
Except for menial positions.
Right.
That was one of the few times that I had a marginal leadership role. I helped to organize those.
Mm-hmm.
I got arrested, taken to jail, released, brought to trial. The trial was a joke. I was convicted in an hour, along with a few other defendants.
Trespassing.
I was also contempt of court because we violated an injunction. I was the one who was chosen to testify. I'm verbal.
Yeah.
I'm not fearful.
Right.
And after the jury rendered the verdict, the judge asked me to stand up. And for about 10 minutes, he basically excoriated me. He told me that I was nothing more than a common criminal, and I was no different from anybody else who was ever convicted of a crime. Wow. And he sent me to the probation department for pre-sentence investigation. The probation officer then sat me down. These are very memorable.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, "Are you sorry for your crime?" And I said, "No, I would do it again." And I was then called back into the judge's chambers. And he said, "I'm going to put you on probation for 3 years."
Wow.
With a series of conditions, the first of which was that I had to go to law school.
Why do you think he made that a condition?
He said that you had a demonstrated propensity to be, I don't remember the exact words, contemptuous of the law.
Oh, and so this way you would just be immersed in the law.
Yes.
And thereby more respectful of the law.
And he said if you choose not to accept the condition, he would put me in the San Diego County Jail for 6 months.
Oh, good Lord.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, I guess not. So you enrolled in law school after that?
I did. And I...
Which law school did you enroll in?
Berkeley.
Oh, okay. You ended up in Berkeley anyway.
And he said he didn't think Berkeley was a good environment for me, but he wouldn't stand in the way. He said there are bad elements in Berkeley and that he didn't really want me to be involved with those elements.
Oh, wow.
But he said, you can go anyway. So I did. 2 weeks into law school, I found it a totally ridiculous experience. I left and I sent the judge a letter saying...
You mean before actually finishing law? The law
2 weeks into it.
2 weeks into it.
I sent him a letter and I said I thought I would go back into the PhD program. And he sent me a telegram. My students have no idea what a telegram is. And the telegram said, "You have 48 hours to get back into law school or it would rescind my probation, issue a warrant for my arrest, wow, and impose the 6-month sentence." So I went back with enormous reluctance.
And you ultimately finished?
I finished. I did it. I'm a lawyer. I passed the bar. I've only done pro bono work. I've done civil rights cases, social justice cases. I started teaching anyway. That's what I've been doing my whole life.
So how did you make the transition, though, from being a lawyer to getting into, and of course, a civil rights activist, into getting to the art part of it, African-American art?
Well, what happened was that I taught one course at Golden Gate College. My parents knew the dean of instruction, and one day I was over at my parents'. They were living in Berkeley.
Okay.
And he said he needed a teacher for intro to poli-sci, and I said, "I can do it." And he said, "All right." And I knew, Eric, I knew after the first day I should be doing the teaching. I just knew it.
Yeah.
And after I did that, I went over to the Department of Rhetoric at the grand old age of 24 or 25, and I said, "You should hire me because I can be a good teacher." They probably shouldn't have, but they did.
Well, you know, I would disagree with that. I think they should have because, as we know now, of course, hindsight's 20/20. But you've received accolades for your teaching. I have to put this in here real quick that Kelly, my wife, has taken, I think, literally every class that you taught at UCLA. I can say that with honesty. Am I right? I mean, that's...
Yes, and I love it, and I'm good at it, and this is year 52 of this continuing odyssey. I love it.
Years.
You know, I know this... This sounds really weird, but I knew after the first hour at Golden Gate College, the very first hour, that this is what I should be doing. A lot of people find that hard to believe, but it's absolutely true.
So wait, so at Golden Gate, what were you teaching there?
Intro to Poli-Sci.
Oh, okay, Intro to Poli-Sci.
And the first book I ever taught was Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh my goodness.
Not exactly the standard Poli-Sci material.
I would say not.
But
interesting, nevertheless, yeah.
But in the Department of Rhetoric, I started teaching other things. And then 4 years later, they had a new program called the Division of Interdisciplinary and General Studies. And I joined that. And the chair there was a man named Alan Renoir. He was the grandson of Pierre-Auguste Renoir.
Oh, my God.
And the son of filmmaker Jean Renoir.
Wow.
And he said, "Paul, you're a wonderful teacher, but this is Berkeley, and you have to write a book." And Ruth and I had just gotten married, and I'll never forget. I said, "Sure, no problem." And I went back at home, and I said to Ruth, I have to write a book. And I said, I don't know how to write a book. The finished idea how to write a book. But then I did. My first book was called The Art of Social Conscience, and it was a history of political and social art. I always loved art. I loved it. I always went to art museums when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I sometimes tell this to students, although I'm not sure I should. I say, look, sometimes I skip class in Philadelphia. And I went to the museum, went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's a great museum.
Yeah.
And even in the when I was in the Civil Rights Movement in Atlanta, they have all those wonderful murals. And I loved it. And there was something about African-American art that just resonated with me. It was part of the struggle.
Right.
Many of these artworks really reflected what we were doing, but it didn't really register with me yet.
It was just planting the seed.
It was just really interesting, and it kind of was in my mind.
Yeah.
So the first book I wrote was The Art of Social Conscience, and it was about the history of political and social art, mostly European.
So it was an art-related book, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I taught a course on it, and as I was teaching it, I wrote about it. It was about political and social art. Goya, Daumier, Kitakovitz, George Grosz. And I was really pleased with it. And then I decided I was going to write a second book about American political art, and I wrote that. But at that point, I realized there was an enormous deficiency.
But by the way, in that second book, were there any black artists included?
Only one. I think Jacob Lawrence.
Jacob Lawrence, okay.
And it was at that point, this was fateful in my life, absolutely fateful. I was still at Berkeley, and I made a telephone call to the person who changed my life. I think she realizes it. I said, I am not dealing with enough black artists. And I got on the phone, and I called Samela Lewis.
Wow.
Because I knew that she was really the dean of African-American art historians. Oh, I knew it.
For sure, yeah.
And I got on and I said, is this Professor Lewis? And yes. I said, you know, I've written now about political art. I've helped move the needle in art history a little bit, even though there was a lot of resistance.
Yeah.
There was enormous resistance.
Yeah.
There were people who really didn't like that I was mucking up art history with political things.
Now, how did that show itself, by the way? Were they sending you letters or nasty
notes? No,
no.
But there was, I had one graduate student in common. She was at Berkeley and she was at UCLA, and she came and said that there was a famous professor who said that von Blum was destroying art history. And
by saying that, she was basically saying by including
these political artists,
it was just poisoning the whole thing.
Yes, and you know, I just wrote an article a couple of months ago. I said that art history has still survived, and so have I.
Wow!
But I called Samela and I said, I really think I need to do more about black artists. They're out there,
yeah,
and I know a few of them. And I said, I know you're the editor of the International Review of
African-American art.
It was then called
Black Arts Quarterly.
Yeah. And I said, I would like to write about Jacob Lawrence because I know his work. I've seen it all over. Mm-hmm. I said, would that be okay? She said, do it. And I did. I wrote an article years and years ago. My first article on African-American art was on Jake Lawrence.
And it was published in Black Arts Quarterly.
Yeah. And I said, this is really interesting. And to fast forward again, in 1980, we moved to Los Angeles. The Brockman Gallery was still up.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of roaming all over L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the Brockman Gallery. I started seeing things.
By the way, Brockman started by Alonzo and Dale Davis.
Alonzo and Dale.
Two artists as well.
Yeah. And so I just started knowing more and more. I started writing about women artists. I started meeting people like Pat Ward Williams. I met Betty Saar. I don't remember the sequence.
Oh, of course. It doesn't so much matter, but Betty Saar, I mean, that
Betty
must have been interesting.
Betty Saar was there. I met her. I met all these other people.
And, of course, Samela, by the way, she's not only an historian, but she's an artist, too. So did you have a
chance? She was the first.
Did you actually interact
yes.
with her?
Yeah. Once I moved from Berkeley to Los Angeles, she was one of the first persons. I went to her house. Through her, then I met Cecil Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
I started dealing with other people who had been involved in the political turmoil.
Yeah.
John Riddle had not come back yet. He was still in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But through all of these people, I got a sense of the struggle to make African-American art respectable, to make African-American art viable, and to make it part of the scene.
You know, what's so amazing to me, though, I just know that you would think, because it's arts, that it would be an area that wouldn't be as reactionary and conservative and racist as the rest of society, especially during the 60s and before and so forth, and even to some extent afterwards. But it seemed like at the same time, it turned out that was the case. It was like by admitting blacks could create art, it was almost undermining that whole racist theory that, you know, black people could actually do something that's considered sort of a form of higher education and learning.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I began to see it. I began to talk to these people, and it dawned on me that I could start both teaching and writing about it.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I was by then teaching both in the communication, it was then Communication Studies Department. It's now changed its name to plain old communication.
At UCLA, you know.
Yes. But I was then teaching also in the African American Studies program. It's now a full-fledged department.
Mm-hmm.
And I became involved with that when I first did my course on Paul Robeson and American Life. I mean, that was really crucial to my own intellectual development.
Yeah.
At Berkeley, I was involved in the agitation to create what was then called Black Studies.
Yeah.
I was really involved in the agitation, and that got me into some political trouble with the university authorities. They resisted it. They resisted it all over the country, but I didn't care. It was really important to me.
And what, what form did that resistance take, Paul?
They didn't want it. The old white men, be blunt, who ran the University of California did not want ethnic studies. They just didn't want it.
Did they say why, or did they just?
No,
just
they
didn't,
said
they didn't want to admit it. I guess maybe.
No, they said this is just a fad. This is just self-congratulations. This is just whatever they said. This is not serious academic activity. This is something that will pass. Of course, it's not. I mean, ethnic studies has been around now for a long time. We helped to create it back in 1969, so it's a half century of doing this. But I was really involved in a very vigorous way in 1969 at Berkeley to create it. People went to jail for it. I remember that. I was on the streets on the Berkeley campus to do it. And then, interestingly, in my office, I kept a coat and tie so I could go out to Santa Rita prison to get people out of jail, and then to go down to the courthouse in Berkeley to get them out on bail.
Wow.
I had an incredible life then. I was running around without any sleep.
I can tell. I mean, between the studies and the activism, I mean, that's pretty...
And I did it.
Yeah.
But when I came to UCLA, it dawned on me that I didn't want to be on the sidelines. I wanted to teach in a field that I really helped to create. Now, many people helped to create it. I was just one player of many, but I was one player.
Right.
And I wanted to be part of that in the curriculum. And so what I started with was Paul Robeson. And so I did the course on Paul Robeson. I wrote a book on Paul Robeson. And that was really important. And then I went up to the chair and I said, there's never been a course at UCLA on African-American art.
And what was the reaction?
I said, good, do it.
That's fantastic.
And I did it. And I started looking at some of the iconic early figures, Henry Asawa, Tanner.
Yes.
But even earlier, Bannister, you know, right. All those people.
And just imagine the challenges they faced, incidentally.
Oh, incredible.
I mean, good Lord.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I just hustled every week. I don't have the energy to do that anymore. Every week
But you're still teaching, by the way.
I still am teaching.
Yeah.
Every week I got slides, you know, and they made slides. I mean, I had to get the carousels and put slides in the carousels. My students have no idea what a slide looks like today.
Oh,
everything
no.
is digital.
No, exactly.
They have no idea what a slide looks like.
Right. I can remember those days, too. You got the tray. Yeah, it's a circular shape. You stick it in there and
you do it.
Press the button and it advances to the next picture.
When I gave presentations, your gallery and...
In Santa Monica.
Santa Monica. Yeah. I would bring slide trays.
I remember.
We did it.
I can recall, yeah. So when was it, by the way, that you met William Pageau?
Oh, he was one of the early people I met. Again, I don't recall the specific time, but Bill and I knew each other for 30 years. When I started doing the research for, even before I did the research for my first book, Resistance, Dignity, and Pride, I did an article or two about Bill himself. We just hit it off.
Yeah.
Bill and I just hit it off. We have, in some respects, the same kind of personality. He was a salty personality, and I just loved it. I just loved the way he talked.
Right.
I just loved it.
Yeah.
He and I just... It was just a perfect match.
Well, he was also the central figure in LA art for sure. African American art in general, but you know, was he working at Golden State Insurance Company when you met him?
I think he had just retired.
He retired in 87, as I recall.
He had either was about to retire or just retired. He knew everything.
Right.
And
he knew a lot of folks too. I mean, he was friends
everybody,
with Charles White and so forth.
Everybody.
Riddle and all the John Riddle and the rest of them.
The stories he told me about Charlie White, just incredible. I had actually had a phone interview with Charlie White shortly before he died.
Oh, wow.
Samella, I think, put me in touch with him. And I got to know Ian. I got to know Fran. I was out to their home in Altadena. I got to paw around with all of that stuff. I got to know Ben Horowitz.
Yeah.
I got to paw around with all of that stuff.
Ben Horowitz, who was Charles White's dealer in Los Angeles.
Yes, in the Heritage Gallery.
Yeah.
But when I was out at the Altadena, I could paw around with that. I could see the documents. I could see the letters between Charlie White and Paul Robeson. I was able to assimilate all of this stuff.
Is there any one thing, by the way, that must have been very exciting, incidentally, to be able to do that. Was there anything that stands out above everything else when you were like looking around and seeing these things with them communicating with one another? Two giants, I mean, Paul Robeson, multi-talented.
I saw these letters, Paul Robeson. They knew each other.
Friends, huh?
I saw these letters and the pictures of Charlie White and the jazz figures.
Yeah.
It was amazing, just amazing with these pictures. I talked to Fran about how they were both at these summer camps. I mean, these were left-wing camps.
Yeah.
About what they were doing. They knew everybody. They knew Belafonte. They knew Pete Seeger. Later in my Robeson book, I interviewed Pete Seeger. And they were all so wonderful. They got me into that community.
Wow.
But Bill and Samella, they helped me into that community. And then when I started writing about these people, they liked what I had to say about them. I think for good reason, because I respected what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wrote obviously very positively about them because I think I recognized that these were women and men of extraordinary artistic quality. They were.
Right.
They did really good work.
Mm-hmm.
They did quality work.
Yeah.
I met John Alderbridge. Through him, I think I met Willie Middlebrook. Unfortunately, a lot of these people have passed.
Right, like Willie Middlebrook, for instance.
Willie, yeah. And
John
too
Riddle.
Early.
Yeah.
John Riddle. And when John came back from Atlanta, he was a font of information. When he was at the museum, we would just leave for 4 hours and go across into the park or over to the SC. We would just talk.
Well, John was the curator at CAM and a wonderful artist, but also just a genuinely good person, I felt.
Wonderful person.
And we were planning a show, by the way, at the time that he had the fatal heart attack, I guess it was, we were actually planning another exhibit. There were some unfinished pieces that he was working on, unfortunately.
I was there the day he began having the chest pains.
Yeah,
I told him to go home. I know, and he knew things. He was an extraordinary person. I mean, he talked about his influences, about Kovitz, about Ben Shahn.
Right.
These were people who knew much more than merely the tradition of African American art, which they also, I must say, knew very well.
Yeah.
They knew it. And it absolutely deepened my personal historical background. I mean, I've read a lot. I mean, you have all those books right there.
Yeah.
I know most of them. I've read those.
And you've written them. By the way, let's just briefly go over that. You've written actually two books on LA artists, LA African American artists, I should add. And so what prompted you to go that direction? Like the first one was Resistance, Dignity, and Pride. Am I right?
Yes, I knew that we had to go beyond helping them to get shows. I had to at least get something there on the printed record. I had to do it.
Yeah.
I had to get this out there so that they would get some kind of scholarly recognition.
Yeah.
Now, I know that there's a long way to go. I mean, I talked to, for example, John Alderbridge. I remember when he had his exhibition at CAM.
Yeah.
It was in, the mid or late 80s. And I'd written a review of it, and I said that if he had been a white artist, it would have been not even at CAM, it would have been at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and would have been 20 years before.
Sure, absolutely.
All I can do is to get this stuff out there so that future historians will consult it.
Yeah.
That's what we have to do.
Plus, by the way, you end up, everybody should know that you have a collection of artwork yourself. Many of these artists you've written about.
I love this collection.
So you have a personal connection.
Yeah, I love it. You know, I get up every morning when I come out of the bedroom into our main room. I have a wall of 12 or 13 works by Bill Peugeot. They're my friends.
Yeah.
I have to say that, and Kelly took that class. I have an honors collegium course where I do field trips. I mean, I've taken people to CAM. I've taken them to the watchtowers. I take them wherever it looks interesting in any given quarter, but the final field trip is to my home. We have a party, and in the middle of the party, I take 40 or 45 minutes, and I take them around the house. And I have a lot of works that the artists themselves have given me. I never, ever solicited. They give them to me. I mean, Dale Davis gave me a wonderful mask. And just recently at CAM, I lent Lamont Westmoreland, another friend. These are friends. These are not subjects.
Yeah.
I lent a Lamont Westmoreland work that Vita, she rest in peace, used. And I was talking to Lamont about that at some opening, and Lamont said, "You can't have an empty space where you're working." And he brought me another piece.
Oh, my goodness.
The piece on that has Edmonia Lewis, one of the people I research and that I talk about when I teach.
She's such an interesting figure in of herself. I mean, think of the 19th century, mid-19th century, she's active. I mean,
absolutely. And I talk about that.
Yeah.
In that show, there was a piece on the Black Panther Party, and Tony Scott said, "No, don't bother sending it back to me. Send it to Paul." Now, I didn't ask for that.
Well, you know, that's probably just a thank you for recognizing them. I mean, just to be recognized and honored is such a wonderful thing. And I think that's I think, anyway, if I may interject my own interpretation, I think that's their way of just saying thank you.
It's fantastic. I feel so wonderfully honored that they would do that. When I got that, it took about 2 hours to get through the packing, but I did, and I have it. It's a wonderful piece, and Ruth said there's no room for it, and I always told Ruth there's always room for art. I can always defy the laws of physics.
That's good. Spoken like a true collector. I have collectors that collect from the gallery, and they're the same way. A lot of people say, "Well, you know what? I can't get it because I have no more room." But Some of the more passionate collectors will find some kind of way, and they store what they can't show, and they rotate in and out. So that's,
you have to do that.
You make adjustments if you're really into it.
Find room.
Yeah,
you find room.
But that's what I love. That's what I love about you, though, Paul. You have a passion for it. I think that comes through in the way you talk, the way you've written about the work, and so forth. There's a definite passion in there.
I love this tradition, and I love the people. I mean, we go to the openings. We try to go as many openings. I mean, every time we go, we see people like Michael Massenburg. We see these people. I love seeing these people.
Yeah, and they love seeing you too,
it's
by
just
the way.
Wonderful to see them.
Yeah.
I mean,
wait, was it at the Charles White show or was it at Betty Sarr show that I saw you that time? At LACMA, I forgot which, but it's just an example of what you're saying.
I think it could have been the Charlie White show.
I think it was
that
Charles
was
White.
Incredible.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, I took my class there, and there were even some Charlie White works that I hadn't seen. For me, it was wonderful.
Oh, my God, it was great. I had the good fortune of seeing it while I was in New York at Museum of Modern Art as well. So there were a few pieces there that weren't at the LA County Museum, but it was still great to see both, actually.
You know, there was a piece there that I've been able to use. He did a piece on a young man named He-Man Sweat, who was the lead plaintiff in Sweat versus Painter. It was a predecessor to Brown versus Board of Education. Thurgood Marshall took that case. He-Man Sweat tried to get into the University of Texas Law School, even before Brown. And he won the case because Texas said, no, we have a segregated law school and you can't get in because you're black. Mm-hmm. And so they created something called, maybe a little off, but something called the Texas Law School for Negroes.
Oh, wow.
And it was in an office building. And they had a few law books and a couple of part-time instructors. And the Supreme Court said, that's not good enough. Even under separate but equal, that ain't good enough. Mm. And they ordered him admitted to the University of Texas Law School. That was 1950. It was a wonderful portrait of He-Man Sweat. I had no idea what he looked like. It was a wonderful revelation.
What an interesting thing to say, though, because I don't think a lot of people even know about that.
No, period. I teach it.
That's awesome.
I do a course called Race, Racism, and the Law. I'm teaching it in the spring. It's new. Kelly had already graduated. So.
Well, you know what? Knowing Kelly, she'll probably come back and take the course.
So it's a new course.
That's fantastic. So Paul, let me ask you this, though. How did you feel when the news hit that Golden State Mutual Insurance Company was going to enter into an agreement with Swan Galleries in New York and auction off what turned out to be a substantial portion of the collection that William Pajot spent so many years putting together? How did you feel?
It's devastating. Probably not as devastated as Bill was. He never really disclosed it, but I know how he felt.
Well, I mean, good Lord, think about it.
I know.
He's the one that used his friendships with some of these artists.
I know.
Because he had a very small budget to add works of art to the collection. And yet he used his friendships and all those kinds of things to get these pieces. I mean, one of the pieces that I keep thinking about, it's in my head, I keep seeing it in the lobby, was of Harriet Tubman that Charles White did.
The masterpiece.
Wasn't it awesome?
That masterpiece. It was there in the Charles White exhibition.
I saw it.
It was like a long lost friend I saw it again. And I started my tour of the LACMA with that one, and I explained everything. No, every time I did the Golden State tours, it was a staple of what I was doing in my teaching.
Yeah.
I started with that. I knew the guard who sat there. You remember him.
At the entrance
to the Golden State. There were really three people who really knew that collection.
Yeah.
Bill, you, and I.
Right.
That was it.
Right. It was like the LA's best kept secret.
That's
right.
I must have given, I would say, 25 or 30 tours of that over the years. Bill knew it, you knew it, and I knew it. Every time they had a new PR director, they would call me to instruct the new PR director.
It was a sad day, though.
It was a sad day. I remember it well. There's still a residue.
Oh, yeah. And that's the one good part. I mean, there's some lots of pieces that are, I saw actually exhibited at a couple of public libraries in L.A., which is nice.
There's a residue, but it's not the same.
Not the same, because as a complete unit, it would have been nice to still see it.
Right.
And those murals, Charles Alston and Hale Woodruff murals detailing the history of African-American contribution to the state of California before it was a state. I mean, that's pretty incredible in and of itself. It's like a history lesson.
It's still there.
And it's still there.
Right.
That was an interesting problem, because the murals were actually painted in New York, shipped, and they were on canvas, shipped to L.A. and then installed. And so the question became, and I'm not sure how it was finally resolved, it must have been resolved in favor of the building.
Yes.
Is it an integral part of the building and therefore belongs to the owner of the building, or is it separate? And, you know, you could take it off. I think technically speaking, it'd probably been hard, maybe impossible. I don't know. I guess it's somewhat possible to take it off, because it was actually canvas.
I know that, but I'm glad it's there. I don't know what the final disposition will be.
Well, that's the problem. I don't either. And it's funny. I don't know. Are people still able to get into the lobby? Do you know?
I don't know. I haven't been there. I drive through there. I occasionally, when I'm driving, I think, should I stop?
Well, you know, in a way, I've been by there too, and it's almost like it's like a graveyard in a way.
I know.
There's a sense of, I don't know, I hate to say it like this, but it's a sense of like death almost.
That's how I feel, which is the reason I don't stop.
Yeah. And then, and then remember Wendell Collins right around the corner of the fire station?
Yes.
Even that, you know, just the whole area. It's like, it's so different.
I don't stop. I mean, the only thing I do stop very occasionally is Thame, the first African-American a Methodist Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
But I don't stop there either, because Chip Murray isn't the pastor anymore, and I've known Chip, you know, for years.
Yeah.
So, all different world.
Yeah, it's sad to say, but it's still good to see those shows like that coming to LACMA. It's, you know, one of the things I noticed, and what do you think about this? It does seem to be a greater, shall we say, mainstream museum focus on African-American art.
A little more.
Soul of a Nation, for instance.
Oh, that was amazing.
Wasn't that a great show?
That was amazing at the Broad.
At the Broad, and it was at Crystal Bridges, believe it or not,
before
that.
But
Tate Modern in London was instrumental in making it come together, which is all interesting to me.
It's great. Now, I haven't been to Arkansas
for
that, although I've been to Little Rock to give a speech on civil rights. I have a great story about that.
Oh, yeah, tell us.
I was invited to speak at Little Rock, and there was maybe a 90-year-old woman who said she liked my speech. Well, I'm pretty vigorous when I speak,
and
so I do it with my customary vigor. And she said, there's somebody probably should meet. I'm always interested in that. And the next day, when I went to the museum at Central High School, which of course is historic, where the 9 courageous young went, she said, call this number. And I did. And it was the number for Elizabeth Eckford. She was the one girl who was separated out. You know, and she had a horrible white racist mob.
I've seen films of that.
Yes, it's
and my heart breaks every time.
It is heartbreaking.
She's this innocent girl, just simply trying to go to school, and you have people yelling obscenities at her.
Yes,
and everything. It's just chilling.
And for 3 or 4 days before, she and her sister were busy working to make a new dress so she could go to school. It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had the opportunity to talk to her.
And what was that like? I mean,
she talked a little bit about what happened that day in 1957.
And what was her feeling? I mean, she had
the look. She still remembers it.
She had the look of fear in her face,
as
I would have been. I would have been afraid,
too. Of course. So it was really important for me to connect with her. I talked to her a little bit about myself having faced white racist mobs.
Mm-hmm.
For her, it's worse. But then when I had to go back to my hotel room, there was an African-American cab driver, and he heard my story from the museum director who watched me. And he took me out of the way. He took me to the Arkansas State Governor's grounds, and he showed me the statue of the 9 Little Rock kids. It's a sculpture.
Oh, wow.
It's a wonderful sculpture. So I have it, and I just showed it to my class last Thursday.
Oh, no kidding.
And I used it.
What was their reaction?
I gave them the story because, you know, I use art to teach history.
Yeah, yeah.
So I used that.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there's the museum. It's, I think, in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah.
It's not very much on my circuit. Eventually, I'll get there. I'm so glad Soul of a Nation came to the Broad.
Oh, yeah. No, that was fantastic.
Yes.
Soul of a Nation. And then, as we mentioned, the Charles White Show, which was at the Art Institute in Chicago, the Museum
right.
of Modern Art in New York, L.A. County Museum here. Very prestigious institutions.
And there's more of that to come. So
I was going to ask you, are you optimistic about this kind of thing?
Progress is slow but steady. So we'll see what we can do. We need more.
Yeah.
You know, there are younger African-American artists coming, but a lot of the people still in my books, unfortunately, some of the people have passed on. Elliot Pinckney died.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Was that recent?
I think at the end of last year.
Oh, wow.
There wasn't much press about it.
Yeah.
So, but many of the people in Creative Souls are still around. And
well, speaking of that book, by the way, tell us a little bit about that book. What prompted you after all those years of the, since the
there were not book? There were not enough people in here. There were younger and not so young people that I had to deal with, and I got as many of them as I could.
Okay.
And I decided to deal with them. People like Michael Massenburg and
yeah.
so many of the other ones, I had to write about them.
Yeah.
Phoebe Beasley, I mean, Phoebe is my age, so I have to deal with these people.
Yeah.
I had to get as many of these people. Then Joe Sims unfortunately died.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get as many of these people as I possibly can.
So when you say getting them, it sounds like you're actually talking directly to them.
Yeah.
Too, right?
Oh, each one of these people I spend time with, each and every one of them. So that's how I'm going to do it. I don't think I have the energy to do another book.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, how long do you see yourself teaching, for example?
Oh, I'm going to keep teaching.
Okay.
Teaching, yes, but doing this kind of an extensive book, I don't think I can do any more of those. I've written 5 art historical books.
Yeah.
I think those days are probably done. I'm going to continue to write books, but I think not so much, or not. I'll probably do the individual articles on art, including, of course, African-American artists.
Yes.
But I don't think I have the energy to do it. I put together an exhibition called Creative Souls at the Watts Towers Art Center. I mean,
when was that?
That was shortly after I had done the book, shortly after its publication.
Oh, okay.
So everybody in the book was represented, Yuné Brown and Mark Greenfield, Dominique Moody, they're all in there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had pieces in there. Dale Davis, everybody had a piece or two or three.
Oh, wow. How long did the show last?
It lasted for maybe 2 months. And Charles Dixon is in it.
Yeah.
Everybody was in it. And that's a lot of work to do it. I mean, Rosie Lee obviously helped, and some of the professional people there helped to assemble it. Noni Olabisi is in it. All these people I've known that I couldn't cover the first time. But I don't think I have the energy for that. That is something I've got to leave to younger people to do.
Curating?
Yeah, to curate.
Yeah.
It's not like I feel sometimes I do feel my age. I mean, I can't ignore that.
Right.
I don't think I want to do any major curatorial stuff. Kelly helped me with the Peter Magobani thing a long time ago, and then I was the co-curator with Mark Greenfield on Places of Validation, and I may do a little bit of that, but I need to kind of conserve my energy for other projects at this point in my life.
Oh, I understand.
The major thing that I want to do is to continue to teach. And I see no end in sight to that. This is year 52.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
My student evaluations continue to be very strong.
Oh, I can easily believe that.
So I'm not letting up on that. I mean, students obviously continue to like it. They continue to sign up in droves.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's
so,
more
the merrier.
So are there any young artists that catch your eye now? That let's say aren't in any of your books?
There's some. I have spent more time with middle-aged and older artists. I will continue to go to the galleries and see who's younger. I have a bias for figurative art.
Yeah.
I like and admire abstract art. I don't generally write about it because I don't really know what to say about it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
You know, there are African-American artists who do that. Sam Francis is a good one. I just don't know what to say about his art.
Oh, yeah. You mean Sam Gilliam?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sam Francis is another one.
He's another artist.
I'm sorry. I was wrong. Sam Gilliam,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a wonderful artist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's terrific. I just don't know what to say. I couldn't write about him.
Right.
You know, there are other ones. What's the artist at the CalArts? This conceptual artist.
Conceptual.
He was Derek Maddox's teacher. Derek is also in the book.
Oh. I can't recall, actually.
Yeah, I can't recall either. A lot of the highly complex conceptual artists, they're interesting, but I don't write or I can't write about them because I don't understand them or I'm not willing, frankly, to put in the kind of cognitive work to do it.
Right.
I mean, there's just so much I can do.
Well, the abstract art does kind of make you work for it. And then a lot of times it's an emotion they're trying to convey.
Right. I mean, and it evokes the emotion.
Yeah.
It's just that I don't know how to translate that into my verbal agility. And I have the verbal agility. I just can't make the translation.
Oh, no, I understand.
Oh, it's Charles Gaines.
Oh, Charles Gaines, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen his work. It's interesting. I just wouldn't know what to write about.
Yeah.
So,
no, I understand.
You know, I have my own limitations. I can live with them.
But see, that's the thing. I think for most of us, I mean, we kind of tend to plug into that art that relates to us in some way.
Right.
We connect to it. And
yes.
It makes sense that you would be able to write best about what connects with you.
And a lot of the artists about whom I write, especially the African-American artists, have strong inclinations to deal with issues of race.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've grown up in this society, they understand racism.
Well, see, that's the thing. I think oftentimes it's true to their experience. They're just simply, it's sometimes, at least my reading on some of the artists, it's not like they're necessarily making a statement. They're basically just relating what it is they had to deal with. Or are currently dealing with, oftentimes, you know, it's like almost a memory.
They've lived with it.
Yeah.
If for no other reason, they've had a harder time getting acceptance in mainstream art circles.
Well, there's a book. I keep forgetting the title. I'm going to have to dig it up. But the authors of the book once said that one problem, they congratulated themselves for looking around for really good black artists, but they simply couldn't find any black artists that were worth writing about. This was in the 60s, this book came out. I'm forgetting the author's names, but essentially what they said, the biggest deficiency of black artists was their tendency to produce art about being black.
I know, and that is preposterous.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. They would actually, I guess, as honest, they're being honest about it. They're just saying what it is they felt. But it seems insensitive and racist to me to say that.
It's extraordinarily racist.
Yeah.
You know, in my first book, I included LaVielle Campbell. I included her because she was my student at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the very few African-American artists in studio art at UCLA. It's gotten a little better. But she came into my office once crying because she said, one of the instructors saying, "Why are you forcing your culture on us?" Well, she's black.
And the key word being forced. She's not forced.
She's not forcing anything.
She's expressing herself.
She's expressing her experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
People do that.
Yeah.
We all express.
What's wrong with that? Yeah.
We all express our experiences. I've been sitting in our conversation expressing my experiences. As it happens,
yeah,
a lot of my experiences intersect with the black community.
Right, right.
Because of the nature of what I've done throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
We express our experiences.
Yes.
It's what we do.
And that's the valuable thing, to open up, to just be open to hearing and feeling those experiences.
That's what we do. Yeah. LaVielle expresses her experiences. Right. People do that. We don't force it on anybody.
Right.
I don't force, when I don't walk down the street, when I go into Ralph's supermarket, I don't grab people and force my experiences.
Of course not.
But in my classroom, I talk about what I do because people sign up for the classes.
Right.
We do. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah. And I think that would be something that's so valuable. Don't you want an honest expression?
Yes.
I don't want somebody to produce a work of art, for example, just because they think that I might like it.
Exactly.
I would rather them produce something that honestly expresses whatever it is they're trying to say.
From my perspective, it's fine for any artist to deal with any topic he or she wants.
Yeah.
It's fine, from my perspective, for any African-American artist to deal with any topic. It need not deal with race. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I remember, I don't remember the gathering, but Samela Lewis was there, and there was some African-American somebody, I don't remember what his or her position was. He said, well, we're in an era of post-black, and I remember Samela in a wonderfully quiet way saying, I don't think we can ever be post-black.
I remember her saying the same thing in a different setting, but expressing that same feeling.
Absolutely right, because in 1,000 different ways, white majority society will remind black people that they're black and that they're different.
Yeah.
It can be subtle, and it's very, very real. My African-American students tell me that every week.
Yeah,
tell me that.
And you know, the thing I think is, it's actually wonderful. We should celebrate our differences.
Of course.
I mean, and help to understand each other better by understanding those differences. I think it's a good thing in a way.
It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
That theoretically should make America what it should be.
Yeah.
It's good.
Right.
You know, this notion that we should all be colorblind, that's of course preposterous.
Yeah.
It's good that we have different colors. People should celebrate their differences. Black people should revel in their blackness. I have gay students. It's fine to be gay.
Yeah.
It's good. I want people to revel in their difference.
Right.
That's what is wonderful.
Exactly. Live and let live, right?
Of course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know. It's intolerance is such an ugly thing.
And hopefully, we still see a lot of it.
And hopefully we can move past it. But unfortunately, it still rears its ugly head from time to time.
That's the reason I'm going to continue to teach, as long as I have the energy to continue to do it.
Well, I'm glad. And I think everybody should be glad, especially if you're a student at UCLA. You should be very happy. So outside of UCLA, are you teaching anywhere else?
No, I do the occasional lecture. I lecture abroad. This last summer, I taught a mini course at the law school at Masaryk University in the Czech Republic. I love doing those gigs. On Saturday, I did a class for the Osher Group. It's a group of senior citizens who want to keep intellectually alive. So I did a thing on African-American art for them. There were a few African-Americans in that group, and I went in and I said basically, hi, I'm delighted to be here. You're old and I'm old. I'm one of you, so let's continue.
It's wonderful. And what was the response?
Right, they loved it.
Excellent.
Now, I know they love what I did. So I do these gigs. I gave a talk a week ago today at the California African-American Museum on voting rights and why they're under attack. You know, I was, as you know, always blunt on what I thought we need to do.
Yeah.
And why they needed to vote, especially this coming November.
It's extremely important, right?
Yes, it is.
It's coming up soon, too.
It is.
And we got primaries coming up.
We do.
Well, Paul, this has been wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
I enjoy it enormously. It's really my pleasure.
Oh, gosh. I consider you a friend as well as a colleague.
So good.
It's really great.
Terrific.
Wonderful thing.
Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. That ends another episode of Eric's Perspective. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to the next time. Don't forget to subscribe. Thank you.